Borough case to come forward and make their arguments. Yes, are you ready to proceed, Ms. McCarty?
May I remove my mask during the argument?
Mm-hmm.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. I'm Colleen McCarty on behalf of Appellant Nevada Policy Research Institute. NPRI seeks reversal of the District Court's dismissal of its declaratory and injunctive relief action on the basis of standing. Under the Separation of Powers Clause, Article 3, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution, NPRI challenged the dual service of then 13, now 9, sitting legislators who also work as executive branch employees, including two Clark County prosecutors who in their dual roles not only make the laws, but hold the keys to the jailhouse doors. This court has already determined that matters of significant public importance, like the issue of improper dual service, can and must be decided by this court. NPR, and they may be brought by a party who will vigorously and effectively present his or her case against an adverse party without the need to show a special or personal injury. NPRI is that party. It is the only party who has litigated this issue in the last decade, not once, not twice, but three times. NPRI meets the factors to qualify for the public importance exception set forth in this court's decision in Swartz v. Lopez. Even respondents concede this case involves a matter of significant public importance. NPRI has asserted a challenge to a legislative expenditure or appropriation on the basis that it violates a specific provision of the Nevada Constitution, here, Article 3, Section 1. And NPRI is an appropriate party capable of fully advocating its position in court.
What legislative expenditure or appropriation?
It's over there.
Sorry, it's hard when you can't see my mouth, huh?
Thank you, Justice Stiglitz.
Kadish. She's Stiglitz.
Yes.
It's okay.
The masks.
Yes.
I'm sorry,
so,
would you repeat
my question?
My
question was, what legislative expenditure or appropriation are you challenging under the second prong of the Swartz case?
There are multiple potential expenditures and appropriations, and as this court is aware, the record below is not developed. But we know that the legislators received a salary. We know that as executive branch employees, they receive a salary. We know that legislators also receive a per diem during the interim for the various activities that they provide.
So which of those are you challenging in this case pursuant to Swartz?
We would challenge all of them. In the event the court disagrees that NPRI has standing under the public importance exception, NPRI seeks a limited expansion of the exception in this case when the issue is of such public importance as to require its resolution for future guidance, as other states like South Carolina and Indiana have done and is noted in our reply brief. For more than 70 years, the issue, actually more than 100 years, the issue of dual service has evaded judicial review and continued unabated, even though this court has said time and time again that the division of powers is probably the most single important principle of government declaring and guaranteeing the liberties of the people. As this court has previously stated, its clear intent to prohibit even those seemingly harmless encroachments between the branches of government, as it referenced in Galloway v. Truesdale, there must be a vehicle to challenge dual service. NPRI followed the roadmap set forth by this court in both Heller and Swartz v. Lopez. It brought a declaratory relief action against the executive branch employees engaged in dual service, as directed in Heller, and it meets the criteria for the public importance exception articulated in Swartz v. Lopez. For the purposes of this argument, respondents concede that the issue before this court constitutes one of significant public importance, but really that issue should not be glossed over. The Nevada Constitution contains an express provision prohibiting one branch of government from impinging on the functions of the other, and the language is plain and it is clear. The powers of the government of the state of Nevada shall be divided into three separate departments, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial.
And Ms. McCarty, I apologize. Me again.
Yes, Justice Kadish.
The dismissal that happened that's being appealed is based on the standing issue, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So when you suggest a limited expansion, what is the scope and contours of that limited expansion that you're seeking to standing doctrine?
Many states have found that when the issue involves public importance and it requires future guidance, that when the court can and should hear those cases, when the court decides that it is indeed a matter of public importance. And
so
we look
any
to
public importance, we no longer need any particular legislative expenditure being challenged. Wouldn't that be contradictory to the constitutional provision against issuing advisory opinions?
I think in this case, when you have such an issue that has been hanging out there for so long and has been considered time and time and time again, this court should, and it does indeed have the authority, to allow for standing to be adopted here.
So if it's been a really long time, we can waive the advisory opinion prohibition?
I think this court would need to decide that it is an issue of public importance that requires future guidance.
Thank you.
As you all know, and I know you've debated this argument a great deal in the last few weeks, the plain language of Article 3, Section 1 is clear. No persons charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these departments shall exercise any functions appertaining to either of the others. Any functions. And when we look at the dual service issue, it is clear that there are overlaps in multiple areas. We have nine sitting legislators who also engage in dual service. And real life examples of the harm attendant to it cannot be ignored. You look to Assemblyman Wendell Williams, who openly acknowledged when he was a City of Las Vegas employee working in the Neighborhood Services Division that he was essentially functioning as a super lobbyist and not representing the interests of the people. When these types of dual service is allowed to continue, it erodes the public's confidence in their legislative branch. We've talked a little bit about the legislative expenditure or appropriation. Respondents are compensated as a result of the legislative expenditures, be it as legislators or government employees, and the compensation is not reasonably disputed, and it occurs in violation of the separation of powers clause, and that satisfies the second factor held in Swartz. The third factor, NPRI is an appropriate party. It is the only party that has brought the action. There is no one else that is likely to bring this action, and it's clearly demonstrated through the briefs and our argument that is fully capable of advocating its position in court. In the Heller case and the respondents,
to the third factor, just briefly, if no one else is bringing this, and you are the only entity that is bringing it, then what are we to take away from that? Because certainly other people have sued before over jobs, particular jobs that they wanted. Those came up and then they went away because they either didn't want the job anymore. So there were instances where individuals who were actually harmed or allegedly harmed by the dual service have come up to this court, not gotten all the way to the goal line because that's what they chose. But the fact that you're the only entity that's doing it, what's my takeaway from that? That it's so important you guys are the only ones that care about it? Or everybody cares about it, but they're just not. I'm not trying to be flip. I'm trying to understand how. What do I do with that?
Well, I think when you look at the realities of litigation, it is an expensive proposition, and most individuals do not have the means to bring these kinds of things. NPRI is an organization that is interested in public policy. It is interested in transparency in government. It is interested in preventing government overreach. And so through its members, which are many, they have put together the resources to bring this case time and time again.
Ms. McCarty, your whole argument, back here. Hi.
I'm sorry, there's a...
It's okay. So this whole argument is about the importance of separation of powers, right? And that's your client's position that you're here arguing today.
Correct.
But doesn't separation of powers also instruct that the role of the judiciary is a narrow one that focuses on actual disputes between involved parties?
It does, except this court has already held in Heller that there is a mechanism to bring this action, and it is a declaratory relief action. Respondents,
your client isn't trying to get any of the positions that are being challenged here, are they?
I believe that was an example in Heller and not the only mechanism by which to bring this case. But this is a question for you all and whether or not that is indeed the case. However, when you look at sort of the practicalities of being able to do that, what if we have 30 legislators engaged in dual service? Do we need 30 plaintiffs? If we have a teacher and a prosecutor, do we need someone with a teacher's license and someone with a law license?
Well, if we have one, which we don't, if we had one, couldn't we rule on the issue and presumably that would be precedent?
Well, the statute involving declaratory relief says that you must join everyone who has a potential interest in the case. And so we have chosen to do that based on the guidance in both Heller and Swartz. The respondents will argue that this issue is one of sovereign function versus any function. We do not believe that is the case. When you look at both the Truesdale case, it makes quite clear that there are ministerial functions that are reserved to the employees of the various branches. The Article 3, Section 1 does not state that there are sovereign functions. It states any functions. We do not believe that there is a limitation reserved to only certain functions in government.
Ms. McCarty, does your complaint seek any financial reimbursement from those who have dual service?
No, it does not. And we believe that the separation of powers outlined to the legislative branch could potentially preclude that. So at this point, we are seeking...
Does MPRI seek any financial remuneration in its complaint in this case as a result of a violation of the separation of powers that it argues?
It does not. It's simply seeking a determination from this court that it is improper to engage in dual service.
So one of the things that is of concern to me relates to the Schwartz decision, which altered the test, at least in state law, in my view, concerning standing. And it deviates from federal jurisprudence on the subject of standing, and I think for good reason, allowing citizens who are impacted by potential violations to acquire standing to pursue these kinds of claims. But there is a limitation in sports, and I think that limitation is that very issue that we were just talking about. So how do you propose, if this court decides to entertain this matter and address it, how do you propose that an opinion would assess that factor in Schwartz, which has been a clear harm factor for the individual bringing the claim? Because you seem to be acknowledging that MPRI is not harmed in the traditional sense, nor does it seek a remedy for that harm.
I'm sorry, Justice, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. We understand Swartz v. Lopez to hold that a personal harm is not necessary. Mm. And when you look at the factors, they are whether or not is an issue of significant public importance, whether there has been a legislative appropriation challenge and whether the party bringing the action is the appropriate party. We do not believe that NPRI as an entity must demonstrate a particularized harm. We believe that if you follow this court's prior holdings from Heller and then more fully advanced in Swartz v. Lopez, this is the mechanism to allow an entity like NPRI to bring forth an issue. And, Your Honors, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Additionally, with respect to the issues involving the legislative intervention and the official attorneys, if I need to address those on rebuttal, I will. Otherwise, we intend to submit them on the briefs, unless there are any further questions for me.
I don't see any, Ms. McCarty.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, may it please the Court, good afternoon. My name is Bradley Schrager, and I represent directly Respondents Miller and Torres. With me on the brief was Mr. Bloom for Respondents Fires and Cannizzaro and Scheibel. I have been charged by the remainder of the respondents as well to handle the presentation regarding the dismissal for standing. I will take up, I hope, about 10 minutes, and then I will cede to Ms. Rhodes Ford, who will address the issue of the right to an institutional attorney. Time permitting, Mr. Powers may get into the issue of permissive intervention by LCB. This is not my first time here, so I'm perfectly aware of the aspirational 10-minute number that I have laid out. But thank you, Your Honors, and again, good afternoon. Your Honors, pardon me. I will absolutely not be arguing anything regarding sovereign function or employee duties or anything of that nature, because those are merits questions. We're not here on the merits. Everyone in these, all these collected cases wants to get or edge to the merits of these cases. That is, at the, and you know, I understand it. I understand NPRI's impatience with getting to a resolution of their constitutional claims. I absolutely understand it. But some of the delay and some of the fact that it's taken as long or as many cases as it have must redound to their own conduct and the way that they've framed these actions. And I will correct counsel and say that they have not, in fact, acted as a party three times. They've acted as counsel three times, right? Or they have been involved in three of these cases. The first two of these cases, in 2014 and 2018, NPRI was able to locate individuals that essentially met the roadmap, that had standing to bring the kind of case they wanted to bring. This is the first time NPRI has decided, we'll do it ourselves en masse. That is where they have misstepped here. But as far as getting to the merits, the case below, none of the what used to be more than a dozen and is now down to 9 respondents, defendants below, none of them have even filed answers, much less briefed the substantive questions. So we're a long way from merits questions for most of these respondents. Now, counsel noted that they followed the roadmap in Heller, followed the roadmap in Schwartz. The way I read their presentation is that they have done exactly the opposite. They have acted in contravention both of the roadmap in Heller, laid out almost 20 years ago, and the Schwartz exception to the personal injury requirement laid out in Schwartz. As far as Heller goes, Heller's advice to anyone bringing these types of cases from this court was that you would need individual plaintiffs with legally protectable interests that would obviously get you standing, specific fact-based inquiries, because each respondent or defendant's situation would turn on unique sets of facts regarding their duties, and a merits decision by a lower court, none of which we have here. Right? So the roadmap has not been filed. Heller did not say, or if you don't want to do that, just gather up a bunch and do it yourself as an organizational entity. So to standing, which is why we're really here. Standing in Nevada for more than 100 years required personal, particularized injury beyond the general interest common to all members of the public, an actual justiciable controversy. Now, NPRI conceded here and also didn't claim in its papers that it met that requirement for standing. So the avenue was through Schwartz. The recently announced exception to that requirement in 2016 in Schwartz v. Lopez. Now, this court was at pains to stress that exception was exceptionally narrow. It was available only if the elements were met. And in the decisions that have, I think there's only been one published decision since that time. There have been a number of unpublished decisions discussing and applying the Schwartz exception to the particularized injury requirement, but only one published one, and that was last month. And as I read through that, Morency, it seemed to me to be a signal that Schwartz was functioning exactly as it ought to. It was a fairly run-of-the-mill application. There was under the bill that they were challenging, there was a constitutional provision that the plaintiffs identified. It was generally agreed to be a matter of significant public importance, and these were the individuals that could expect to have some relief by the actual resolution of the case. Right? Now, they wound up not winning the appeal, but that's fine. The door that Schwartz had opened for them, they unlocked with the proper keys. Schwartz was functioning as it ought to. Now, Schwartz, as we know, requires an issue of significant public importance, a challenge to a legislative expenditure as violative of a specific constitutional provision, and that the plaintiff must be an appropriate party. Now, we have, in essence, conceded at least arguendo, right, that this is an issue of significant public importance. I don't mean to do that for all times and in all situations, because I would agree with Justice Stiglitz that, you know, there is something about being the only ones talking about this issue that at least raises the possibility of a counter-argument regarding its significant public importance. And things can become important in one epoch and less important in another. So I wouldn't waive that forever. But for the purposes here, let's move to the second and the third prongs of the Schwartz exception. MPRI does not identify properly that it's making a constitutional challenge to a legislative expenditure or appropriation. They're pointing to legislative per diems, legislative salaries. Now, contrast that with the monies at stake in Schwartz v. Lopez, the ESA monies, or the AB 458 monies in Morency. Those were the points of the action. Those are the reason the cases were brought. That was the point of the Schwartz exception, so you could get at those expenditures identified as specifically unconstitutional. But MPRI is not suing the respondents here as legislators. They can't. So the legislative pay or the per diems of the legislators doesn't seem to be particularly relevant. And in fact, even if MPRI is successful here or below, well, that legislative pay will still flow to the legislators. Right? So it strikes me that the requirement in Schwartz isn't merely incidental. Find some money's going somewhere. The point of that narrow exception was to identify the unconstitutional expenditure and appropriation of money and to permit citizens to attack that without showing personal injury. Far from being the main objective of the suit here, legislative per diems are essentially immaterial, or at least incidental here at best. So MPRI has failed at the second prong. Theoretically, we wouldn't even need to get to the third prong of the Schwartz exception. But I think it's useful for guidance for future litigants and for courts to discuss that, because MPRI seems to conflate appropriate party as somehow implicating its legal acumen. But that's not what it's about. It's not about whether they're good lawyers, whether they can make the case properly. In my reading, appropriate party means that you embody the claims of the case, right? That you would be the best, most direct beneficiary of the relief in the case, even if no particularized injury could be traced, not just to you, but to anyone. And you are the likeliest to seek redress and to prosecute the claims. Now, by their previous conduct and what they told the district court below, MPRI has demonstrated they are not an appropriate party in that sense. Twice over the last 10 years, they have found individuals, Mr. Perdunas and Mr. French, to take on these cases, to be plaintiffs, to show that they want the jobs that they are claiming a legislator is usurping in violation of separation of powers. So they've shown they know how to do it properly. They just haven't done that here. and in their papers, they tell the district court, we have plenty of supporters who are willing and able to take on the jobs these individuals, these legislators, are currently in. So what they're saying is, we could have done it the right way, and we know how to do it the right way. We just didn't. Right? That's not acceptable. And that does not give you appropriate party standing. But let's speak plainly for a moment, because it's reasonably clear NPRI does not meet the Schwartz exception here. But they want more than that. So let's be clear about what they want. They don't want a limited exception or a limited expansion to the Schwartz exception. What they're really asking for is to get rid of the Schwartz exception. When you say, let me out of prongs number 2 and number 3, what you're saying is leave only the public importance exception. That would swallow and destroy the requirements of standing that have held in this state for over a century. Because that would then lead to any district court that thought that it was important enough could bestow standing upon someone to hail someone into court. And I want to say very, very clearly, the power to hail someone into court is an awesome power. Right? Before cases get to you, they have normally gone through years and tens of thousands of dollars. Right? The fact that there are these elements to Schwartz that make it clear to district courts what you have to meet to open and unlock the courthouse door if you cannot show a particularized injury, the fact that you have those elements, that's what makes it plausible to conduct those cases and eventually come to you. Otherwise, there is effectively no break on standing if someone identifies public importance. So I think we're not talking about a limited exception. We're talking about a radical proposed disjuncture with the entire law of access to courts in this state for the last 100 years. And with that, Your Honor, if there are no questions, I will cede my time.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Who would you envision as having standing to challenge what is asserted to be a violation of separation of powers by service in the legislature and either prosecutorial functions or the exercise of something else? Does it have to be someone who wants the job? Is that the only person you can think of?
I think that that's probably, as this court said in Heller, that's probably the best example. It's hard for me at this moment to think of those that would also fill those shoes, but in the two cases that were brought, Pojunas and French, nobody questioned their standing for this very reason. And I think it's not just because the court said this is how you do it. I think it's because, you know, the desire to dislodge that person, because you are now taking up someone else's space. Right? You are qualified for that job, but you can't because someone is violating the separation of powers. I think that makes the clearest case. It is hard for me to imagine a rule that could put someone else in those exact shoes, I think.
So is there any reason why we wouldn't consider every citizen of the state to have an interest in their elected representatives being free of conflict or violative of separation of powers such that anybody could have standing for that?
Well, that would swallow the possibility of any limitation on standing. It seems to me that the way the court has gone about it for the last 17 years, claiming that there should be individual plaintiffs with legally protectable interests, including, as a best example, the desire to fill that job themselves. You know, then you're just back to the generalized sense that standing in this state for the last 100 years has said is insufficient. So the answer to that, I guess, is no.
Are there any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Schrader.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Rhodes Ford.
May it please the court?
Yes, ma'am.
I am Berna Rhodes Ford, General Counsel for Nevada State College and attorney for the Enchi defendants, respondents Dina Neal and Jill Tolles. The Enchi defendants are also represented by Gary Cardinal, Assistant General Counsel for the University of Nevada, Reno, and Chief General Counsel of Enchi, Joe Reynolds, who is present here today. This case is not really about the statute. The statute is clear. This is about penalizing legislators and forcing them to pay out of their pockets for representation. As an essential matter, NPRI, just as it doesn't have in the main case standing, it also doesn't have standing to question the disqualification, to question counsel in this case.
Ms. Rhodes Ford, did your brief here on the appeal argue that it didn't have standing to raise the issue?
It did not raise it in detail. It referenced standing in our appellate brief. But even if we get to the merits of the disqualification, there is no basis to overturn the district court's decision. For the first time on appeal, NPR says it would not appear that Enchi is a political subdivision. The court should not consider this argument. And if you do, NRS 396 expressly defines Enchi as a political subdivision. So moving to the substance of the argument, we are required as official attorneys to represent the Enchi employees. NRS 41.0338 defines official attorney as the chief legal officer or an authorized legal representative of a political subdivision in an action which involves an employee. NPRI wants to only reflect on the portion of the statute that relates to the performance of public duties. However, the first portion of that definition strictly involves an action which involves employment. If you look at NRS 41.0339, the plain language of the statute requires representation. Council has referenced Cannizzaro as being a basis for disqualifying the attorneys. However, Cannizzaro was a conflict of interest case, and there were two sides in that case. One set of legislators was not allowed to have representation by LCB. The other set of parties were allowed to have representation. And we would argue that we are in the same seat or same position as those attorneys who were allowed to have the representation. We believe this is a choice of counsel issue and that our employees ought to be able to have the attorneys of their choice, and the statute requires it. And even if you, Your Honors, decide that the statute does not require it, there is a case, Kenmore versus Toco, that says NRS 41.0339 does not, it only mandates when we must represent employees. It doesn't say when we may. So we are permitted to, whether per statute or outside of the statute, to represent those parties. And if there are no questions, I will yield the balance of my time to Mr. Powers.
Thank you. I don't see any questions.
Thank you, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin Powers, General Counsel, LCB Legal Division, on behalf of the Legislature of the State of Nevada, who was allowed to intervene below as an intervener defendant under NRS 218F.720 and NRCP 24A1 and also NRCP 24B, which provides for permissive intervention. The legislature has an interest to intervene in this case and has a statutory right to because, as the pleadings have indicated and as NPRI has argued, they're claiming that this involves a legislative expenditure appropriation. Ultimately, as Mr. Schrager argued, it doesn't, but intervention is based on the pleadings. And in the pleadings, they raise the legislative expenditure and appropriation. And yet they say the legislature doesn't have an interest in that, even though the legislature is the only body that actually can make a legislative expenditure appropriation. So the district court correctly determined that under 218F.720, the legislature had an interest. In addition, 218F.720 authorizes the legislature to intervene when anyone challenges the meaning or applicability of a constitutional provision. In this case, in their pleadings and their complaints, they specifically say this case involves the meaning of the separation of powers provision and its application to these particular defendants. And therefore, under that portion of the statute, the legislature also has the ability to intervene. And finally, the district court authorized the legislature to have permissive intervention. And we know permissive intervention is wholly within the discretion of the district court. So even if there was an intervention as a right, the district court was well within its discretion to grant permissive intervention to the legislature. So I just wanted to cover those intervention issues. Since I have a few seconds left, I just want to turn to the standing issue that Justin Herndon mentioned. If you look at this court's case in Luck versus Tootin, there a plaintiff challenged a judge in saying that they were disqualified under the Nevada Constitution from serving in their office. The plaintiff said that the reason they had standing was because they needed to enforce the Nevada Constitution on behalf of all citizens. This court rejected that flat out. That would undermine standing in every way, shape, or form. Every citizen has an interest in constitutional government. But the reason standing exists is because the court only deals with actual cases or controversies where people have personalized individual injuries. So in Luck versus Tootin, the very argument that MPRI is trying to make here, that they're defending the Constitution, was rejected by the court. And that ends my brief period of time, but I'm certainly open to any questions.
Mr. Powers, I'd like to follow up on the argument you just made. Is it the case that in the last session of the legislature, indeed every session of the legislature, the legislature's initial acts include the adoption of the budget for the legislature for the session?
That is correct. The first bill that's passed in every session is an appropriation to the legislative fund to pay for the cost of the session.
And inclusive of that budget, is it the appropriation to pay the legislators' salaries during session?
That is correct. That is part of that appropriation.
So is there a reason why the appropriation that's authorized for the session to compensate legislators would not be encompassed in the second Schwartz factor?
Well, I think what MPRI is trying to do is use that appropriation to work its way into the Schwartz factor. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, they're really challenging the payment of the legislators in their public employee capacity by either the executive branch or the local government. They can't, as Mr. Bradshager mentioned, undo the legislative appropriation. The legislature chooses who's qualified to sit in the legislature and chooses then who gets paid for their legislative salary. So that can't be the appropriation here, because this court would violate separation of powers if it told the legislature it can't appropriate money to its members. However, the true attack would be on the appropriation of the executive branch or the local government. But in order to do that, you need to name defendants who are in charge of those expenditures, either the paymasters of the executive branch or the local governments who are paying these legislators as public employees. So in that context, these legislative appropriations and expenditures don't qualify under Schwartz.
So you're saying that the court lacks the authority under separation of powers doctrine to invalidate an appropriation that it determines to be void because you paid somebody that wasn't qualified?
What I'm saying, the court doesn't have the power to invalidate a legislative appropriation to legislators who the legislators have been seated by each House. If the House seats the legislator, that's conclusively determined that they are the legislator, and then the legislature appropriates money for their salary. To say that the legislators couldn't receive that salary would say that they weren't qualified to serve in their seats, but only the legislature can say who's qualified to serve in their seats. Conversely, this court can invalidate appropriations made by the executive branch and the local government, the actual expenditure of the appropriations, but not the appropriations themselves. This would be saying the executive branch or the local governments can't expend that money for these public employees because they were to violate separation of powers. Obviously, you know from the Plumlee case and all our briefing, we believe there's no violation of separation of powers here. The problem is MPRI didn't go after any of those expenditures. They didn't. They didn't attack an expenditure by any of these executive branch employers, NSHE or any of the other ones, or the local governments, district attorneys, public defenders. They didn't go after any of those expenditures. They only mentioned legislative appropriations, and so they don't qualify for Schwartz for that reason. I'm certainly open to any other questions.
I don't see any, Mr. Powers. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. McCarty?
With regard to the NSHE defendant's first-time assertion that NPRI does not have standing to challenge their representation as official attorneys, I would respectfully suggest to this court that that's never been raised before, and we would ask you to disregard it.
That wasn't raised in district court?
No, it was not.
Okay.
Additionally, with regard to the legislature's continued assertion that we are asking you to define the meaning of the separation of powers clause, we are not. We believe that the separation of powers clause is clear on its plain language. We are asking you simply to enforce it. With regard to the second and the third prongs of Schwartz, the second prong talks about a legislative expenditure or appropriation that violates a specific provision of the Nevada Constitution. As this court is aware, this comes to you on a motion to dismiss. And I would like to read the complaint for you so that it is clear, indeed, what we have alleged in our pleading. Paragraph 28 of our complaint says, quote, without this court's intervention, legislative expenditures or appropriations and taxpayer monies will be paid to defendants in violation of Nevada Constitution Article 3, Section 1, and irrevocable and irreparable harm will occur to the rights provided under this provision of the Nevada Constitution. That has what's been alleged here. And we believe that it clearly speaks to the second prong of Schwartz.
Well, Ms. McCarty, how would you respond to Mr. Powers' discussion that we just have about, you know, to the extent you're saying they can't get paid for their service as legislators, that would be challenging their legislative service, which we can't get in the middle of and isn't what you're actually arguing.
Actually, what we're arguing is that a legislative appropriation would be improper under the Nevada Separation of Powers Clause. We're not necessarily arguing...
Because they're not qualified to be legislators.
No, they are qualified to be legislators. There's nothing in the authority that speaks to whether or not how they get paid, right? We know that the Separation of Powers Clause does not allow us to decide whether they are qualified, but it does not speak to how they are paid. And we believe that we have properly asserted in our complaint a legislative expenditure or appropriation in taxpayer monies paid to the defendants. I understand that they want to try and pin this down, but please remember, we were in the district court. We never had the opportunity to develop this record. Frankly, we got short shrift by Judge Crockett. I'm not entirely sure why. But we are before you now with the pleading as it was written, and we believe that it is sufficient. Additionally, with regard to the third prong, whether or not we are an appropriate party, Schwartz talks about an appropriate party as someone being in a position who will be likely to bring an action and whether they're capable of fully advocating their position in court. We are fully capable of advocating our position in court. They talk to you about the prior cases. We brought individuals previously. That is correct. Schwartz v. Lopez didn't exist at that time. We believe now that when we follow the framework of Heller and Schwartz v. Lopez together, that there is no need to bring an individual plaintiff. And in the French case, the court dismissed the action on the basis of NRCP 19 because we had not joined the appropriate parties. And so when we look at how do you want us to do this, if we need to bring a plaintiff, we are happy to do that. But we believe that when we look at this court's prior holdings, particularly Schwartz v. Lopez, that NPRI as an entity qualifies under the Schwartz v. Lopez public importance exception. No one is disputing the public importance here. No one. And so and the other prongs we believe we have met. If not NPRI at this time, then who? And if not now, when you have not only our case, but the three criminal cases related to the separation of powers that you're dealing with. It is clear this is an issue that the public is interested in and concerned about.
Are those criminal defendants in a better position than MPRI to challenge this issue?
No.
Why not?
Because Heller makes it clear that it should be a declaratory relief action, and that is what we have brought to you. If additional guidance is needed as to who should be the proper plaintiff, we are happy to have it. But we believe we have met the Swartz v. Lopez exception. We believe that it was created for this purpose. When we look at that case, this court decided that the ESA issue was of public importance because it looked at the law already in existence that you have to fund education first. When you look at Truesdale, Galloway v. Truesdale, it goes to great lengths to talk about why this matters, why the separation of powers guarantees the liberties of the people. There is no doubt that this is a public importance, and we would ask you to apply the public importance exception. And of course, I'm here for your questions if there are any more.
Are there any questions for Ms. McCarty? All right, thank you, Ms. McCarty, Mr. Schrager, Mr. Powers, and Ms. Rhodes-Ford. We appreciate your arguments here today.
Thank you.
The matter will stand submitted.